All right. Hello and welcome back. I'm Eric Sunset, your host of the Doc Buddy Journal. Here at Doc Buddy, we deliver healthcare solutions that take the pain and cost out of broken workflows. Today, we're joined by Casey Duhartz. Casey is the Chief Labor and Employment Counsel for Acadia Healthcare Company. She's based in Tennessee, and she provides legal advice and counsel regarding allegations of discrimination, harassment, retaliation, and wrongful discharge claims brought under federal and state employment laws and regulations. Casey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's our pleasure. You're going to be a great guest for the show. I can already tell. And one other upcoming speaking engagement you've got beyond the Doc Buddy Journal is you're actually going to speak at the ASCA 2024 annual conference taking place next month in Orlando.
I think it's a perfect time of year and a perfect place to have a conference.
Yeah, they picked a great venue too. The Gaylord's a fun hotel, lots to see and do there. And it's always kind of fun to be in the bubble at a Gaylord. You've got one in your backyard, if I'm not mistaken, up there.
We sure do.
Yeah.
Yes.
So obviously you bring a lot of expertise to the table around employment law and staffing. Your speaking slot is around managing human resources like a pro. What can you share that won't spoil your talk?
First of all, if anyone, you know, comes to the conference and they want to sit in on the session, when you leave the session, you're going to be like, I'm in the wrong industry. I need to go to law school and become an employment attorney because this is so much fun. I say all that to say sometimes people look at an attorney coming in and speak to them as something that's going to be boring and drab. That's not going to be the case. We're going to have a great time. And we're going to talk about employment law basics 101. There's always a why behind the what of not just treating employees like we should be valuing and treating employees, but why we have to do so according to federal and state law. And I think sometimes when you understand, oh, what Title VII is about, and oh, why I can't really fire that person while they're out on medical leave, and oh, why I shouldn't misclassify someone as being a salaried exempt person when they really should be hourly non-exempt. Like when you put all of that together, it helps you to make the right decisions for your employees, which helps to make your workplace run a lot smoother. So when you come out to the conference, if you come to my session, you're going to learn about those employment basics 101. And I will also be around to answer questions that you may have that you may be like, I don't want to pay an attorney $500 an hour to answer this question when I can just go right to Casey while she's there. So that's kind of a little snippet about what my session is going to be about.
Oh, that's fantastic. And you've got a gift because you look at it on paper and you may say, oh, this is just a bunch more laws I have to follow and be aware of. And I got to deal with all these details. But I think if you look at it the right way, you can flip that on its head. It's something to truly be excited about.
It is. And it's exciting. It's fun. And it helps you see the bigger picture when it comes to the workplace. And when I go to the conference, this isn't my first time speaking at the ASCA conference. There'll be a line of folks afterwards asking questions because some of them don't have a human resources department. Or they may have someone who's doing like having a million different functions or wearing different hats, and human resources just happens to be one of them. So they don't have the time to really do a deep dive into knowing about these kind of laws. And this is an excellent way to try to get that information and make better decisions for the particular surgery centers.
I know you're right about that. I would imagine a lot of ASCs across the country don't have that specialized knowledge base, you know, internal to the center. They may be relying on their PEO, they may have external counsel they talk to once a year, you know, when they see a problem or they're presented with a problem. So having said that, what are, you know, like what's kind of new in the world of ASC labor laws? What should people be aware of? Where are folks getting tripped up? Kind of what do you see? What's on your radar?
Wow, I see so much. So first of all, I work for a behavioral healthcare company. So I'm in healthcare. I was at a law firm for a while, transitioned over into being in-house counsel. We have roughly 250 facilities throughout the United States that primarily delivers mental health care to people, whether that's eating disorders, methadone clinics, rehabilitation centers, residential facilities, all of that. So I work in healthcare. A lot of the issues that I see are not just only situated to the healthcare industry, but also across other industries, hospitality, automotive, technology. The type of issues that are really popping up, number one, I see a lot of wage and hour issues. Mm. When I mean by wage and hour, some people just, we're in a tight, okay, we're in a space where gas costs a lot of money, right, per gallon, where a loaf of bread costs a lot of money. Things cost a lot of money, and some employers are trying to save money. And one way they do that is they're like, hey, let's just go ahead on and make this person a salaried, you know, exempt person so we don't have to pay them overtime. Now, can you pay someone a salary? Yeah, you sure can. However, it's a two-part test. The first test under federal law is that you have to make sure that you're paying them this certain salary threshold. They have to make sure you're getting, they're getting paid something that's, you know, it changes every, depending who the president is. But there's a threshold of how much they have to get paid. That's the first test. The second test is they have to actually be doing job duties that will make them be exempt. If they are just like a scheduling coordinator, where they are just putting patients in, scheduling them, they may not fall under a particular job duty exemption that will allow them to be a salaried exempt person. So although that surgery center or that employer may be saving money by putting folks on as salaried and not paying them overtime, it can kind of bite them in the butt in the end of when someone says, yo, I'm being misclassified. What they'll have to do is go back to a 2 or 3 year look back period and tally up how, like, what hours they worked and how many hours should have been calculated for overtime. They have to pay that money back to that person. And if it gets to the point where that particular claim is delivered to the Department of Labor, the Department of Labor investigates it, not only will that employer have to pay what's owed, but as like a slap on the wrist for like bad job, you shouldn't have done that, they'll also do liquidated damages. Well, they'll double it. So if someone is owed $3,000, you'll have to pay them $6,000. And you can't retaliate against them. They still got to stay employed there. So sometimes knowing when to put someone as an exempt employee is really important. So I understand people try to focus on trying to save money, but I'm seeing a lot of lawsuits of misclassification of folks when they really should be hourly non-exempt, but folks are just putting them as salary exempt. That's one.
I would imagine that in that instance, obviously employers need to be following their federal and state laws, certainly don't want to give any false pretense to this, but I would imagine that misclassification suit or complaint isn't in a vacuum. You're going to have an employee that's dissatisfied with some other aspect of their employment and they say, hey, or maybe go to attorney and the attorney says, hey, you have another issue here, not only this. So you're getting a double whammy by not doing it the right way to start, right?
Right. You must have heard some of my other speeches because I've said that before. Oh, really? Where that's kind of how it pops up, where I've seen it. Someone gets terminated for slapping a patient, right? Like, you've slapped a patient, like, yo, the termination was justified. But they're like, no, they didn't terminate me because I slapped someone. They terminated me because I'm a Black woman. So they go marching to an attorney's office and this is why they terminated me. And the attorney may be like, you know, well, yeah, you did slap someone, so that could be a justifiable termination, but let me look at your pay records. And especially in the state of California, OMG, if you get one penny wrong, like one penny wrong on a pay statement, there goes a plethora of other penalties that get associated with it. So although that attorney may be like, you don't have a case for discrimination, but you do have a case for wage and hour violation, that's normally how that stuff pops up.
Better just to do it the right way from the outset. Avoid all of that pain.
One thing that I'm finding out too, I've seen it at my own company. Some people really think they're doing right by saying like, hey, on the flip side of just trying to save money, maybe like, hey, it'd be so much easier if we pay this person a salary so we don't, you know, they can make sure that they know every week what they're getting paid. And it would be above $18 an hour threshold. This, if we put them a salary, they could be making probably $25, $26 an hour once you calculate it. And they may really think they're doing a great job by, you know, no good deed goes unpunished. But then on retrospect, it's like, yeah, I understand you were trying to do that, but they didn't fit the job duties exemption to be classified as that. So sometimes it's just like an honest mistake that happens, but the law don't care if it's a mistake, you still got to pay it back.
No, whether it's contract law or looking at federal and state laws, what does it say? What does the law say? Not what do you think it says? So obviously the pro tip here is if you're unsure, talk to somebody that knows.
Right. Most sure. So that was wage and hour. Another thing that I'm seeing pop up a lot. Normally people will file a charge of discrimination with the EEOC or whatever state agency's there. or they may bypass that protocol if they want to. If they want to file in state court, some states say, hey, you don't have to go through this administrative process. You can just file your lawsuit in state court. What I've been seeing, especially at my company, is that there are folks who are going to the NLRB. The NLRB is a National Labor Relations Board. And some folks think that, oh, the NLRB, that's just for companies that are unionized. No. The NLRB also handles matters for employers, for employees who are not unionized. The whole purpose of the NLRA, which is the National Labor Relations Act, is to protect employees from being squandered from speaking out in the workplace. So you may have an employee that is disgruntled and they'd be like, man, my manager is just a blankety, 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 blank. And then they put that out on social media. And you know, social media spreads like wildfire, where that message may get back to the manager. And the manager is like, you're disparaging me. You're fired. That is actually a violation of the NLRA because if the employee is speaking out about issues with the workplace, even if they may use some choice words, it's protected speech. It's protected activity. And what I see is that instead of an employee starting to, hey, going to the EEOC or their state agency, they're going to the NLRB because it also depends upon what president's administration is in, you know, is enacted. And with this particular presidential administration, the NLRB is totally, totally employee friendly, and they will put up a fight, and there is not much negotiating room. And so when they go to the NLRB as an employer, it's kind of like, oh, you know, what am I going to do here? There's not much negotiating room here. And so I'm seeing a lot of employees going that direction. So just be careful when it comes to employees speaking out in the workplace, whether it's on social media, text messages, talking to another employee, you know, instead of squandering them, find out why they're unhappy. Talk to them. It may uncover some things that you're like, oh, wow, I didn't even know this is going on in the workplace or that they felt they feel like this. And so having those conversations with that employee may stop them from filing some type of charge with another administrative agency, and just talking to them could possibly resolve the problem.
And to go back to the point we made earlier, I would imagine that you hit that tipping point as an employee. There is going to be more than one thing going on. You know, as human nature, we'll put up with a lot, and then you hit that breaking point. Everybody's breaking point's a little bit different, but then as an employer, you're going, oh my gosh, this, that, and the other is happening in addition to your upset social media post, which I know better than to retaliate against that. Communicating with employees seems like a really key area of managing human resources like a pro.
Very, very much so.
Well, and to that point also around somebody makes an upset social media post and you go and you just fire them. They're terminated. That seems bad. It is bad in just a simple employment law perspective. But in the world of ASCs, hiring and retaining staff has really never been tougher. My current refrain on this is, go to Becker's ASC any day of the week. Go check out the news. There's almost certainly something on the front page around employee turnover, around shortages, or around surgery centers that can't do procedures because they don't have the staffing. Mm-hmm. How can, Casey, how can the right policies and procedures help you to either enhance staff retention so that you're not losing people that you don't need to be, or to even be able to make the hires that you need?
Right. That's a great question. I will start off by saying the right policies. I think every employer, every employment establishment should have policies and an employee handbook, all right? If you have those policies and employment handbook, make sure that it's updated. You don't want to have I saw one employment handbook that was completed on a typewriter. This is how old it was. It was like back in the 90s. And I'm like, yo, this is like 2021. And they wanted me to take a look at it. I'm like, this ancient document, like we just need to shred it and start over from scratch. Like we're not using this hieroglyphic manuscript, right?
Truly, there have been no laws passed between now and the 90s that would matter to employment. Right. Not one.
So like the ADA, a whole bunch of stuff. So make sure that you're updating those policies and employee handbook. But more importantly than just making sure that you have those things in place, because you can have a library of information, but it's not helpful unless it's being utilized, right? So make sure that if you're having those policies in your employment handbook, that you're actually abiding by what is in your policies in your employee handbook. Because if you have a particular policy and you are not abiding by that policy, then if something were to happen and that employee was to be terminated, and then they, let's say they file a lawsuit and there's depositions and the lawyer says, you know, is this policy ABC? Yes, it is. Did you abide by policy ABC when it came to this employee? No, I did not. Doesn't make you look good, right? So first of all, make sure that if you have the policies and the procedures in place that you're abiding by them. Also, what gets a lot of staff members upset and get them out the door is when they feel that those particular policies are applied differently to other people. Women may feel like, oh, they're holding me to this policy, but they're not holding a man to a policy. Or a Hispanic person may feel like, oh, they're holding me to this policy, but they're not holding a Caucasian to this policy. Like there are all, like someone who is an atheist may say, oh, they're holding me to this policy, but they're not holding that Baptist to that policy. You have to make sure that you are holding those policies uniformly across the board so that people do not feel as if they're being discriminated against. Case in point, if you're like, hey, if you have three no call, no shows, you're terminated. If that is in your policy, right? And then you have a particular Black employee who comes on the scene and they have three no call, no shows and you terminate them. Are you abiding by the policy? Yeah, that's what the policy says. But then what if you have a white employee who comes on board and they have five no call, no shows and they still don't get terminated? Although you applied the policy correctly for that one person, you didn't do it uniformly across the board. So when that employee, you know, goes and not only files a lawsuit, but when word spreads, because, you know, some of these surgery centers are small, gossip travels quickly, like, oh, they're discriminated against, you know, certain classifications or protected categories of people because so-and-so didn't get terminated. Then, hey, and I've heard managers say, well, so-and-so's a great employee. They had issues. You know, we were being lenient. No. You can't do that. You have to make sure that you apply them evenly across the board. A lot of times when people have issues with staff retention, yeah, it could be that that particular surgery center or that employer is paying $15 an hour and the competitor down the street is paying $20 an hour. If you don't have the budget to up it to $20 an hour, okay, there's only so much you can do to keep people, right? But if there are things that you can do to keep people, but like I said, having policies in the place, making people feel valued, making people feel respected, they will have a loyalty to try to stay with you, even if somebody's offering, you know, a $2 or $3 incremental increase elsewhere. And also on the point of being valued and respected, when it comes to my desk of dealing with employment issues, now, mind you, we have 23,000 employees at our place of business who I have to deal with issues every day. This is one thing I always tell our human resources people. If we have to terminate somebody, you have to understand they're losing their source of income. They have to go home and tell their family, I lost my job today. We don't know people's financial situations. They could be living paycheck to paycheck. They may have to go home and sit down with their significant other or with their children to try to figure out, how are they going to put food on the table next week? How are they going to pay their rent for the next month? How are they going to make their mortgage payment? Like, how are they going to get gas in their car? So you better be darn right if you're going to make an employment decision that adversely affects someone, that you are not just doing it legally by federal and state law or any city regulation, but you're doing it morally as well. And that right there, I always tell people that is like the driving point to managing human resources like a pro, is making sure that you're dealing with people, not just FTEs or number, but real human people. So treat them as such, value them as such. People know when they're valued. People know when you care for them. And so make sure that when you have these policies and procedures in place, you're applying them uniformly across the board so that people can also know, like, hey, we have stuff in place that if I have an issue, I can go to my manager, I can go to my supervisor, I can go to my human resources person, I can vent, I can talk to them. And even if I'm wrong, they'll investigate it, they'll get back to me, and they'll take my concern seriously. And that's one thing that helps with staff retention is when people feel valued, they feel heard, they feel respected, they'll have a sense of loyalty, and they'll want to stay and ride out the waves.
What you just said is something that I don't think is lost on many. I think most understand it, but putting it into practice and sort of integrating it into how you operate your business. What you just said, people are more than a number on a spreadsheet. They're not an FTE, they're an employee. They're not a salary expense, a benefit expense, you know, they're a person. If you're able to integrate that into the sad end, terminations, you're going to be aware of that on the positive end. Happy staff, right. Good patient outcomes. Everybody's bought into the culture. And to your point right. about chasing that $2 and $3 an hour raise, if you have to do it, you have to do it. And that employee is going to go find that $2 or $3 an hour raise. Or like we said before we started recording, go become an employee of the hospital. Totally different workplace, totally different culture. Right. This isn't a small operation anymore. You're a cog in a machine. And if that's what's important to the employee, I imagine they're just going to go when they get the chance.
Right.
But on
the, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say on the retention end, the culture aspect driven by sound policies, driven by the application policies to all equally, regardless of any right. circumstance, you know, that retention is going to become easier. Is that what you see?
Yeah, that's exactly what I see. Out of the 250 facilities that I say we have, there are some that I call my problem children, where there's just a lot of issues that always pop up with certain facilities. And sometimes you have to do a deep dive and look a little bit deeper as to why are there so many disgruntled people coming out of this one space? What's going on? And when you do a deeper dive, you're like, if I was working there, I'd probably feel the same way too. So that may require a change in leadership to be like, those who are leaders right now, they are not the right leadership for this particular facility. We got to make some choices from the top end to be able to help everybody that's in this area right here.
Yeah, and it does. It flows from the top, even in organizations that are really flat, where the CEO isn't necessarily up here and frontline workers down here, but where it's, you know, really crunched down, where it's super flat, good lines of communication. We're getting a little bit into organizational psychology here, which I like. I think that's really interesting. But it all does flow from the top. The application of policies and culture comes from the top, no matter how flat your organization is.
Very true.
Well, we touched on it a little bit with our compensation talk here. When we're looking at surgery centers or we're looking at healthcare as a whole, how do you get compensation right? Because there's always somebody that can pay more. You know, what all goes into that? Because that's a big piece of retention, obviously.
Yeah, I would say, of course, market analysis, making sure that you're staying up to date on the market trends to see what competitors are paying, what's the cost of living in the area where you're at, and making sure, I think the biggest one, is making sure that you are not being discriminatory in how you are paying your employees. With the Equal Pay Act, the federal law is taking it very seriously when it comes to making sure that women and men and people across just different protected categories. When I say protected categories, I don't want to say any like legalese, y'all know what I'm talking about. Protected categories are those who like your sex, your gender, your race, religion, whether you're like disabled, what your disability status is, your age, all of those are protected categories. So making sure that you're not playing onesie twosie when it comes to compensation, so that if you're called on the carpet, you don't ever want to be put in a spot where like your female staff is being paid $17 an hour, but your male staff is being paid $21 an hour. There can be differentials in pay, but you have to make sure that you have really good evidence and support to back up why you're making those decisions, and not just based upon, you know, well, the men work harder because they have to lift patients and the females don't. Like you don't want to go that part. So making sure that you're doing your market analysis, staying up to date on current trends in that particular community, because I'm quite sure I live in Nashville. What a healthcare worker may be getting paid in Nashville may be different from what someone's getting paid in Tuscaloosa. No offense to Tuscaloosa, Alabama. I'm just saying the cost of living may be a little bit different. So you want to make sure, you know, that you're staying up to date with that. also with compensation, yeah, we have the federal minimum wage limit, $7.25, but then there are many states that have their own minimum wage as well. And you got to go with whatever is the highest pay. So make sure you're staying up to date with that. I already spoke about making sure that you are 100% certain of whether you're paying your employees, should they be salaried exempt or should they be hourly non-exempt. It's a very sticky issue that even the best get wrong. So if you have questions about that, you need to reach out to outside counsel who can probably run an audit for you to make sure that people with their job descriptions are being classified correctly. Also, if you have staff who are hourly, but you still require them to be on call, like they got to be accessible to their phone, like when they clock out, they got to be accessible to the phone in case something happens with the patient, or you send them an email and they have to respond to the email after hours or respond to a text message after hours, you have to compensate them for that time. So make sure that you're not like, oh, I just sent her like a, you know, 2-second text message. It took her 5 minutes to get back with me. You don't want to get into that whole riff of whether it's the minimus time. You don't want to get into all of that. Make sure that if they're doing any work off the clock, that they are being compensated for that work if they are an hourly non-exempt employee.
And I'm not a lawyer, obviously, but in this off the clock work, compensation's a part of it. You can get yourself into trouble there as an employer. I would imagine there is some type of liability exposure you incur by asking for work off the clock as well. Is that right?
It could be. One thing that I've seen issue when I was at the law firm that happened where someone always wanted someone to do some work off the clock, right? But this person, it started requiring them to take certain materials home. So if they were asked to, you know, question that they about a patient, they can just easily have certain documents together because at that particular place, they didn't have an EMR system. It was just like mostly a lot of paper stuff. And that broke HIPAA. You can't just take patient information home with you. So you have a violation of HIPAA. You don't want that because you got to report that in. And it causes a whole lot of issues. So to the best of the ability, you know, if you can keep things completed while on the clock, then do it. But off the clock, make sure that, you know, the managers know not to bother the employee unless it's an extreme emergency, and don't put the employee in a position where they have to take, you know, documents home related to patient information that could possibly be a violation of HIPAA.
And this is tongue in cheek and maybe not funny to our listeners, but don't break any laws. Number one, definitely don't break federal laws if you can avoid it. And, very true. Again, that's silly, but.
No, it's true. So where I work at, like I said, I manage a lot of the employment litigation. And when I have to talk about budgets with the operators at these facilities, like your litigation budget is going to be this amount because we have to do X, Y, and Z in court, you know, and they get all huffy. And I'm like, yo, don't blame me. If y'all didn't break the law, we wouldn't be in this position anyway. So stop doing illegal stuff, you know? Yeah. It's kind of like, okay, ha, 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 Casey. I'm like, it's not my fault, you know? So yeah, but you're right. Don't break the law. You won't be in these particular situations.
Now, I want to go back to something you said around doing market analysis around compensation. You know, I would imagine a lot of surgery centers, a lot of independent surgery centers, I can't speak to the management company operated surgery centers, but I would imagine a lot of their HR needs are handled by a PEO that handles payroll, handles taxes for you. So they're your W-2 of the PEO rather than of the surgery center. They can offer you a lot of support around employee handbooks. And I guess I'm long walk for a short drink of water that when it comes to employee handbooks, the PEO may or may not be enough. You probably should consult an attorney in your state, you know, the jurisdiction which you operate. But then for market analysis, for somebody that's at a surgery center and they're going, man, I'd love to just make a hire. I don't have time for market analysis. I don't have time for anything, but I'm going to interview this person and I'm going to throw a number at them and we're going to see. What would you recommend to that surgery center administrator or owner or operator? How do you get that number? How do you know what's going on around you?
Right. I don't think that it's the wisest thing to just like pull a number out of the sky and hope to God that they take it. I think that although they may be in a crunch to hire, because a lot of healthcare facilities are in a crunch to hire with a lot of staffing shortages, the best thing to do would probably be to just take 5 minutes to ask. Like just ask. if you're hiring for a certain position, there's three or four other people who are already working there at the position, ask what their compensation is so that you can kind of make a number that's comparable to that. Because the last thing you want is to hire somebody at $30 an hour when you have people that have been working there for 5-6 years and they're still making $21, $22 an hour. When they hear that, they are going to flip their lid, right? So number one, if you don't have time to do a deep dive market analysis, right, because that does take time, then just look at the compensation that's currently there. If the role is already there, to see if you can get something that's comparable to that, because you don't want to start any upheaval with those who are already there, yeah, dedicated to work there.
And it gets you right back to your retention issues. And then you have a brand new hiring issue at the tail end of that, right?
Right. And can I say something real quick? I don't hope I'm not talking out of turn. Sign-on bonuses. Can we talk about sign-on bonuses right quick?
Yeah, of course.
I'm not against sign-on bonuses. I think they can be very helpful to bring people in the door. But one thing that I've seen since COVID, when, you know, essential workers, we need all the healthcare people we can get. We're going to give 10,000 sign-on bonus here, and you get a sign-on bonus, you get a sign-on bonus. And people started getting smart. And like, I can get hired, be with this company for 90 days, quit with them, go somewhere else and get another sign-on bonus. And it was kind of like they were kind of working the system. So one thing that we had to enact in place was, if we're going to do a sign-on bonus, you don't get the whole thing, like your first paycheck, right? We will break it up. After the first 30 days, you get this much. After the next 60 days, you get this much. After the next 90 days, you get this much. When you do that, it's kind of like, yeah, sign-on bonus, but also retention, kind of like they worked for it. Because what some employers want to do is, we'll give you a $5,000 sign-on bonus, but if you leave us in a year, you got to pay it back. There are some states where you can't claw back a sign-on bonus because it's considered a wage. You can't do it. So then you get yourself in trouble when you're sending out these legal letters saying, pay us back. When it's like, no, under state regulations, I don't have to pay you back. So that's why it's always great, if you don't know the state laws, to go head on and just break that sign-on bonus up in incremental, like every 30-day parts, so that if they do leave, they didn't get all of it. They just got kind of like what they worked for. So just be cautious when it comes to sign-on bonuses.
That's a real pro tip. And you have to really look at incentives. You know, how does the incentive chain align between employer and employee? And then the knowledge of the law, obviously. My refrain has always been, if you're not sure, find an attorney who is going to be sure, because if you're not a lawyer, you really don't have a lot of business interpreting laws that can impact you either positively or negatively.
Right.
And you said the magic word, it's a dog whistle, COVID. We're at the other end of it. I'm down here in Miami. We didn't have a whole lot of turmoil around it. Hopefully our listeners didn't have a whole lot of turmoil around it either. But there's obviously a marked shift from pre-COVID, during COVID, which is its whole other animal. And now I think we're at the other side of it. We'll knock on wood. We don't see a COVID-24 or anything like that. But around policy and around law, what was the biggest change for facilities? And as a tail end of that, what should facilities be doing now that maybe they didn't have to do before 2020?
I will say this. I don't have a laundry list of what facilities should be doing now that's different from then, right? Because I think that with all the regulations that were coming out in place, even lawyers, government officials, those in our, you know, Senate, House of Representatives, people, we were making stuff up as we went to try to just do the best that we could with what we had. I think if anything, COVID empowered people, especially in the healthcare industry. It empowered them to be like, I need to speak up about my rights. Because it got to the point where they were working endless hours, you know, getting sick. And then it started to shift to where they weren't really feeling valued and appreciated for what all the hard work that they were doing. And since COVID, I've seen an uptick in employment-related cases where people are like, I don't have to take this. If I feel a certain way, I'm going to make my voice be known. I'm going to file X, Y, and Z. Whether it's related to a facility not having the supplies that they need. And one thing that also is an uptick that I see now in our facilities in 2024, OSHA, okay? You know, OSHA is the federal law to make sure that workplaces are safe environment for their employees. And there's been an uptick in OSHA cases. And remember, OSHA is the federal law. other states, some states have their own like mini version of OSHA. Like for Tennessee, we have something called TOSHA, right? The Tennessee OSHA. And so what I've seen is that there are many people who feel comfortable now going to OSHA. I work in a behavioral healthcare industry, so there may be nurses that call OSHA and file a complaint to say, hey, you know, this patient threatened me. I don't feel this is a safe workplace. I need you to come out here and do an investigation. And OSHA does it. So I'll say from COVID, if anything, people feel more empowered to really stand up for themselves and go file these lawsuits, or not even file a lawsuit, file a charge, get in contact with a government agency, do something to make their voice heard if their workplace is not a safe environment. So just like be careful of that, even outside of, oh, you know, they don't clean up blood within a certain amount of hours like they should. Even outside of that, if they just feel that their life is just not safe while they're at work for, I don't know, X, Y, and Z, they do. And it's a free process. OSHA don't charge you for filing a complaint. They don't. So that's one thing I would say from COVID that I've seen an uptick in that. And also people requesting, this is kind of a sticky issue, but I'll say it anyway. From COVID, some people developed PTSD and anxiety and other disabilities or impairments that affect the mental. And sometimes you can't always see that. It's easy for someone to come to work with a sling on, right? Or a cast, and we can make all these accommodations for them. But when they come in and say, I'm dealing, you know, with something that's mental, some people don't take it seriously because it's like, girl, you fine, go to work. But not taking the time out to really go through that same interactive process to understand if they need an accommodation for whatever mental impairment that they may be dealing with at the time, and not treating it as a disability as they should, a physical disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act. So I think COVID as well, like there are people who I deal with who are still wanting to work remotely, or if their position allows them to work remotely, or like full-time remote, or maybe come into the office 2-3 days a week because they still feel this sense of anxiety or PTSD that came from that isolation period in COVID and everything that went from that. And I still see cases that are kind of flowing from that, even in 2024. So be careful of that when someone is coming to you expressing a mental impairment that you may not see, but something that they're battling with. Don't think they're just trying to manipulate the system because you don't know.
Right. Right. That is a sticky issue. Tough to navigate that one. And I have a point of curiosity for you. The prior example, you have the nurse, it's a normal day at the surgery center, generally a fine place to work, no outstanding issues. And you have that patient come in and threaten them. They feel unsafe, but it's a well-operated facility and just comes out of the blue. Somebody's having a really bad day. So they file the OSHA complaint. What's the remedy? What can be done there?
So that's a great question. The remedy. So what OSHA will do is they'll send the complaint to the employer, and they will give the employer an opportunity to respond. When you respond, it's maybe a 1-2 page response. And then also OSHA may ask for documents. So if we're dealing with workplace safety, what workplace safety policies do you have? What kind of procedures or standard operating procedures do you have if a disgruntled patient comes in? I deal in behavioral healthcare, where we deal with patients who have, you know, mental incapacity sometimes. So there are certain techniques that we have to use to calm that patient down, to de-escalate them. OSHA wants to see, how has everyone been trained in these de-escalation techniques? Are there videos to see the situation that happened? How many times has this happened? It could be a one-time occurrence at that particular surgery center or facility where someone, like you said, was just having a really bad day and took it out on a nurse. If that's the case, then we show OSHA like, hey, we have everything in place that we need to de-escalate the situation. That's what we did. OSHA will leave it alone. But if it's a situation where it's happened over and over and over again, and finally somebody called OSHA, they'll ask for incident reports. How many times has this happened with various patients within a span of 1 to 2 years? And if it shows that, this is kind of like a pattern and this employer is not taking their workplace safety environment seriously, OSHA will slap down some citations. Excuse me. When I say citations, number one, it could be monetary. The monetary penalties, there's no spreadsheet to where you can like connect what the monetary penalty is. OSHA just comes up with a number. It's negotiable, but that starting number OSHA comes up with. So you have monetary penalties. Then, of course, there's various tasks that you have to do by certain dates, by certain deadlines. You have to do that. And there's a notice that you have to post for everybody in the workplace to see that you, you know, violated something under OSHA and you have to do this, this, and this to get it right.
So it sounds to me that if you're a center, and even though you're doing everything the right way, you need to have documentation of the incident. And obviously, we'll ask our listeners, if you have questions, consult your attorney or talk to Casey at ASCA. You can grab her for a minute. But it sounds like OSHA is looking for fault. OSHA is looking for liability. And if you can't show a paper trail, like, we have incident reports, here's our policy, we train on the policy, then you have a problem then. Even if everything will be going right.
Exactly. The one thing I always tell folks is, remember, OSHA agencies, the court, whoever your audience is, they're going to look at you as being the sophisticated party. That's what we call the sophisticated party. And you as a sophisticated party, if you don't have your stuff together, if you don't have those documents, it's a losing battle. It's a losing case for them. I always say the longest memory is the shortest pencil. So make sure that you document everything that you can. So if you're caught on the carpet as that sophisticated party, you have the evidence or the documentation in place to support whatever needs to be supported.
Yeah. You say you did it. Show us that you did it.
Right.
Yeah. That's hopefully a lesson you can learn in advance and not the hard way on that one.
Right.
Well, Casey, we're kind of winding down our hour here. Love to ask my guests their thoughts on AI and healthcare. What do you got for us?
You know, one thing that I will say, I don't want to know what the future state of litigation is going to look like when it comes to AI. You know, if a healthcare facility relied upon AI to treat a patient and something goes awry and either the patient dies or the patient is left with, you know, I don't know, deformities for life, you know, I don't want to know what that litigation looks like. I am not on the AI train just because I'm just like old school. I'm not. The AI is like all the new rage right now. And one thing I will say is when it comes to patient care, you can't just take the care out of patient care and just rely on AI totally. When it comes to your employees, I would rather have a person, when I say touch me, I'm not just talking about like physical touch, but touch me as someone who is taking care of my health than a robot. Can AI be helpful in ruling out diagnoses and stuff like that? Yeah, probably. That's above me. I ain't no doctor. I'm a doctor of laws, but I ain't no doctor of medicine, right? So I'm not going to be the first one to knock it. But if we're talking about, you know, employees and trying to like, hey, it'd be cheaper just to replace employees with these robots or this AI stuff, like, don't put your common sense out the window when it comes to, you probably need to have certain employees in place for certain things. Like I said, I deal with behavioral healthcare. It'd be really hard, excuse me, to rely on AI to help our patients with their mental issues that they go through. Sometimes it works best if you have a person that's there in the room to help walk them through their issues and talk with them through it, like literally have a body in place. We're all addicted to this. Oh, sorry, that's my kid. We're all addicted to our phones. We're addicted to devices. We're addicted to everything tech-wise. And sometimes patient care is a little bit better when there's an actual person there and not just a device. But that's all I'll say on that one.
We see it very similarly. You can't take the care out of patient care, at least not today. Who knows what the future holds, but it's very much a human-centered business.
Yes.
And it is a business. Let's not lose sight of that. We want to provide great outcomes, but the reason we're talking about employment law and ways to avoid employment law snags is because you are running a business. You got to keep the lights on to treat new patients, obviously.
Very true.
Well, Casey, we've covered a lot of ground, but I got to ask you, if you could just put one thing out into the ASC universe that you want every ASC owner, operator, employee, surgeon, surgical tech, anesthesiologist to know, what would it be?
I was at a conference this week, and the conference was for those who were operational leaders of our facilities, and I just deal with employee issues all day. all day long employee issues. I really don't know what these CEOs and CFOs and divisional presidents deal with on a daily basis trying to run an organization. And something that someone said at the conference was so helpful. They said, you know, yes, we take care of patients, right? But just as much as we take care of patients, we should even more take care of the people who are taking care of our patients. Don't forget about the people aspect. Don't forget about your employees, those who are helping you make your money to run your surgery center so that you can have money in your pocket to drive your nice car. Don't forget about the people who make your business what it is. They are the foundation. If they ain't happy, your patient care is not going to be happy either, right? So keep the main thing the main thing. Yes, take care of your patients, but take care of the people who take care of your patients.
What could I possibly say to follow that up?
Should I do a mic drop?
Yeah, there you go. That's it right there. That's going to be the clip for our episode, I think. Well, as we wind down, you mentioned that you've got a really cool TikTok account before we started to record. Where can people find you online?
Yeah, so I had to actually look it up. It is at Casey the Employment Addy, ATTY. At Casey the Employment Addy, that's on TikTok. I'm not like a huge TikToker. I don't have a huge following, so I'm not a social media influencer. But from time to time on my TikTok account, I will give like a 1 minute spiel on employment something. So maybe you can take it away or not. I also love to work out. I'm into bodybuilding. I'm an amateur bodybuilder. So I may have like tips on there about like, I don't know, working out, exercise. I don't know. But most of it is like employment related stuff. So just look me up on TikTok if you want to and just watch videos. You can comment. I don't know. What do those young kids say? Like, subscribe, share.
Oh, it's funny because I'm just about to go down that path myself. Oh, that's cool. I didn't know you were an amateur bodybuilder. What's your favorite lift?
Okay, so when I'm in the gym, so right now I'm a figure competitor where like it's all like muscularity and stuff. So right now I love doing anything upper body. I love shoulder presses, chest presses. I love doing Arnold's. I love all of it. Upper body, lower body is okay. I love squats and deadlifts. Don't get me wrong. My legs are like noodles when I'm finished at the gym, but that upper body lifting, lat pull downs, all that. Ooh, that's my stuff.
Love it. Love it. Well, Casey, thank you so much for your time today. This has been awesome to have you on the show.
Thank you. I've had a great time. I appreciate you having me on.
And on behalf of the entire Doc Buddy team, thank you for listening. Be sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube as well, so that you always get the newest episodes of the Doc Buddy Journal. Until next time, I'm your host, Eric, and we'll talk to you again soon.